Masterworks of International Relations, SIS 604. This is Lecture 11 on Hedley Bull, the British scholar, the late British scholar, not on Bull as in, well, you can imagine what a lecture that's just called Bull might actually be about if it weren't about a gentleman by the name of Hedley Bull. But anyway, this one is about Hedley Bull, and in particular about his understanding of the anarchical society and where that fits into the disciplinary history that I've been sketching so far in this particular lecture series. Recall that one of the major metaphors that I have been using to describe this has been the notion of a fractal split, a debate that occurs within an academic discipline, the terms of which are then repeated and replicated in slightly different ways by the parties that are produced by the initial split. Now, political science split off from history, when it initially sort of became a discipline in the early part of the 20th century, did so on two major grounds. Political scientists were generally more interested in making general claims than historians, and political scientists were generally more interested in drawing contemporary lessons from the sorts of claims that they were in fact able to produce. So the idea was that political scientists wanted to turn historical information and do things with it, that historians were much more interested in reconstructing particular points in time, were not really all that interested in looking at. Now, this debate, because it is a fractal split, doesn't simply happen and then cease. It's not resolved, and it's not even resolved by the initial split. It's not resolved when the political scientists kind of pick up and move across the hall from the history department and say, okay, we're going to have a political science department now, or a government department now. Instead, this same debate continues within political science, this debate between sort of on the one hand generalizers who want to draw contemporary lessons, and on the other hand people who are less interested in generalization and less interested in contemporary lessons. Any political scientist compared to a historian is more interested in general claims and contemporary lessons. But within poli-sci, the same debate basically replicates over time. Now, within the United States, you end up with a series of movements that try to claim a particular place within this emerging, re-emerging split within the new discipline of political science. There is, for instance, a movement called behaviorism, and the behaviorist impulse, very strong in the 1950s and into the 1960s in political science and in international relations in the United States, is the idea that the only thing that's actually important are concrete behaviors that are measurable and, in fact, are quantifiable. So if you want to know anything about anything, it follows that what you should do is you should look at quantitatively accounting for various kinds of social interactions. You should look for behaviors, you should look for ways to measure them. There's an element of this in Carl Deutsch that we read last week, particularly all the stuff about how one operationalizes communication. That's very much a kind of behaviorist-influenced way of thinking about how to analyze social reality. Another American movement that is tremendously important, late 50s into the 60s, is what's called structural functionalism. And structural functionalism is an emphasis on the kinds of functions that social institutions and organizations perform. Those functions are thought to explain the existence of those social institutions and organizations. So a functionalist would look at primogeniture, the idea that the oldest son in a family receives the inheritance. And if they want to try to explain what that was doing in, say, medieval Europe, then a structural functionalist would say, okay, what function does this play within the structure of the society? What does primogeniture do? And how is that linked to various other things that go on in the society? Or the division of labor. What is the function of the division of labor? And how does that end up connecting to other parts of the social structure of a modern industrialized society? So that was sort of what structural functionalists would end up doing, and that was a very big deal in the United States for many years in the late middle part of the 20th century. There are some other movements I think worth mentioning here. One of them is what's affectionately called the COW Project, the Correlates of War project. This is a quantitative project that's run, still run, at the University of Michigan. The idea, quite simply, was to gather quantitative data on every event, every conflict event, every security event, every event that would possibly have any kind of relationship to security or conflict that happened in the world. Right? Gather all of this data. And using a set of consistent metrics and coding schemes across all of this vast amount of interaction data, the hope of the Correlates of War project was to actually come up with some generalizable claims or general laws about how conflict occurred and what it meant for conflict to occur. And this was run out of the University of Michigan, and for years this is what people would do as PhD students at the University of Michigan. They would go down and down to the room where the Correlates of War coding was done, look at newspapers and kind of code how events were going on at a particular point in time. And the idea was that if you did this for long enough and measured every possible kind of factor and had a large enough data set, then eventually you'd be able to figure out some systematic patterns that would actually tell you why wars were occurring. So that was the hope. That was the goal of the Correlates of War project. Remains the goal of the Correlates of War project. And another sort of subclass of American movements, things you get that really become important within the American context, various kinds of individual level formalisms, cognitive stuff where people are talking about cognitive filters and systematic patterns of information processing that go on either in individuals or in groups or in bureaucracies. For a while, there's a whole vogue in the 1960s and early 70s for what's called cybernetic decision-making theory, which is the application of certain notions about control structures and feedback loops to the study of how bureaucracies process information and how decisions get made. The sort of current manifestation of those kind of individual-level formalisms is what we would call rational choice theory, kind of formalization of individuals as rational actors along the lines of neoclassical economics, and then the attempt to figure out, given different kinds of preference orderings and strategic situations, where the equilibrium points are when different actors interact with one another. And in IR, that, of course, sometimes gets scaled from the level of the individual all the way up to the level of state, where states are understood to be big rational actors in some way. And you get a whole bunch of interstate bargaining theory that comes out of this, and a whole lot of stuff about how institutions can create new equilibria points, etc., etc., etc. Very, very big in the United States, has been big for a while, continues to be big in terms of American IR, American political science. Now, all of these American movements occupy the same side, if you will, of the intradisciplinary split within political science between systematic generalizers on the one hand, who are interested in drawing present lessons, and on the other hand, people who are interested in historical specificity. All of these American movements move further in the direction of general claims. Right, these are all attempts by various scholars to seize that particular ground. We are the generalizers. We are the ones who are really going to be delivering on this promise, this bet that was made by the original political scientists when they broke away from the historians. And the idea is that the mantle of science will be better served by these kinds of initiatives. So to be really scientific, you have to be quantitative. Or to be really scientific, you have to be formal. To be really scientific, you have to look objectively at functions played by structures, etc., etc. So all of these things take place within the idea that there's something called science. Science is achievable. Science is something we are supposed to be achieving. And each of these different kinds of American movements offer ways of fulfilling that particular, I don't know, goal, dream, project, something. An attempt to reach for that security of knowledge, that ultimate surety of knowledge. That is what all of these movements are in many ways about, trying to advance IR down that particular road, to push political science into that state of being where it would actually be able to deliver on these things that had been promised. Now, not everybody within political science bought this, of course. This represents one very specific kind of side of political science as a discipline. The critics, who are much more interested in historical contextual specificity and things along these lines, the critics would tend to say of the self-proclaimed scientists that the self-proclaimed scientists are, in fact, occupying a realm in which method dominates substance, and instead of knowing anything about anything, we know a lot of techniques and a lot of procedures. And there's some clever things that go on with modeling, but people don't actually know anything. So this is one of the critiques that's often leveled from the other side of the discipline at those that are really trying to systematize in these particular ways. So there's always this tug of war within political science, the same tug of war as you get within IR, between, on the one hand, these science pushes for general laws, and on the other hand, this context-specific contextuality. This is complicated within IR, and within political science in general, by the question about who the audience is for these things. Because the more one goes down the road of certain kinds of technical specificity, the easier it is to lose track of everybody except the specialists. Because you need such a specialized vocabulary to be able to talk about these things with a certain degree of precision. And often, within political science, it's those that are not particularly interested in generalization and general laws and are not particularly interested in producing knowledge claims that look and function like the sorts of knowledge claims that come out of economics. It's often the people who aren't interested in any of that who are speaking in language that is closer to what quote-unquote ordinary people speak. So what will sometimes happen within IR, within poli-sci, is the opponents of a certain kind of technical scientism will say, no, we would be better, we're the better direction for the discipline to go. And the reason we're the better direction for the discipline to go is because people can understand what we're saying. And the scientist's reply is, it doesn't matter if what you're saying doesn't actually hold up, if what you're saying actually is not verified, it's not valid, then it doesn't matter if you're speaking a language people can understand, and we're the only ones who can actually assure general validity. So this is the sort of back and forth, epistemological, methodological back and forth that you get within the discipline. Now there's another kind of movement that occurs, a sort of shift that is, some traces of this show up in IR, but this is very relevant for sort of the history of political science as a whole, which is the notion of area studies. This is kind of a hybrid way of organizing social scientific research, because on the one hand, if you're doing the study of an area, you need to have and generate detailed knowledge of that particular region. So if we're doing European studies and we need to know something about Europe, so we have to be deeply embedded in a set of contexts about Europe. Field work and lots of practical experience and reading and history and literature and so on and so forth. But on the other hand, if we're doing anything within political science, the idea is that the study of a region has to be complemented by the use of theoretical instruments that are actually broader than that region itself. So you have here the bringing together of these two different sides of the interdisciplinary debate, where we have thick context, grounding of particular kinds of claims, but we also have broader kinds of theoretical and analytical tools that are being used to make sense out of that thick empirical domain. Now, area studies is very interesting because it is basically invented as a way of doing political and social science by U.S. strategic priorities and is funded by a separate section of one of the Education Acts. And a lot of money comes out of those U.S. grants and are given to places, right, given to various universities, and the universities then set up a regional studies center using this money. I believe, don't hold me completely accountable for this, but I'm almost positive it's called Title VI money. But what happens is this money comes in and centers get set up. That money is used to do things like fund professorships, pay for and support grad students, fund different kinds of graduate student research. In this way, U.S. strategic priorities start to influence and shape A, the way regions are defined, what counts as a region, what you can actually get funding for, and then what you do within research on that region. So people who were Soviet area specialists, well, were primarily interested in Kremlinology, trying to figure out what was going on in the Kremlin. That was the sort of research that got you rewards. That and position of Russian nuclear weapons. That was the kind of thing that the grantor, the United States government, was very, very interested in during the Cold War. So, you know, you got lots of money for that. And if you could link it to that, then, you know, you could go study Russian literature. That's fine, because Russian literature might give you some insight into Russian psychology, which might help you be able to figure out whether and when they were going to, you know, launch nuclear weapons at you. So everything had to be kind of linked back to that. Regions got funded in different kinds of ways, right? The African Studies regional institutes were often just about how do you promote development, and that was what they were primarily interested in. Latin American studies, again, how do you produce economic growth? How do you bring Latin America under the beneficent rule of the United States in the hemisphere, etc., etc.? So U.S. funding, U.S. government funding, U.S. government strategic priorities is very important in shaping the very idea of area studies. Why is this important to us? Well, it's important because area studies grows up and becomes comparative politics. The whole panoply of theoretical tools that comparativists use to analyze their subject matter came out of these area institutes. And so the big debates within comparative politics about specificity versus generalization, also known as richness versus rigor, which is a sort of opposition that makes its way into IR as well, because in IR and comparative, actually, international relations and comparative politics, a very, very thin boundary between them. They're both interested in things in the broader world, and they're both interested in sets of interactions that aren't necessarily confinable to the United States' involvement. So, you know, you can get quite a bit of overlap between them, and sometimes it's very difficult to tell in a place like Europe, say, the difference between an IR specialist doing Europe and a comparativist doing Europe, to the extent that Europe integrates and European states start to pool their sovereignty in various ways, then IR and comparative studies of Europe start to look pretty similar after a certain point. But it's important to remember that these area studies and the notion of studying an area was and remains in many ways intimately linked with the idea of certain strategic priorities of the U.S. government. There's a lot of money now in area studies in the United States in the Middle East. Not so much money in other areas. But Middle East, terrorism, oh yeah. Plenty of cash for that. Plenty of cash for those sorts of things. And that has an effect on the way in which that knowledge is produced, and it's important to keep in mind. Everything I've talked about so far is within the United States. But not all international relations scholarship takes place in the United States. On the other side of the pond, which is to say on the other side of the Atlantic Ocean, there are other things that are happening, which are not directly connected to what goes on in the United States, though they are affected by it. See, European international relations and political science in general has its own kind of internal fractal split. One of the two poles is very Americanized scholarship, where you have several European scholars basically participating in American debates, bringing back the results of American debates and sort of rerunning them in their own home turf. But then you have, within Europe, a sort of autonomous tradition of studying politics and studying international politics, which is much closer to diplomatic history and to philosophy than the American version, which is connected with certain kinds of mathematization and automation and formalization and so on and so forth. And American IR and American political science sort of quickly sheds a lot of that stuff. Sheds the idea that you can produce good knowledge through techniques that aren't quote-unquote scientific or aren't reaching for a particular kind of quote-unquote science. European IR never quite forgets that, right? This is the place where E.H. Carr sort of founded things. Instead of Morgenthau coming over and people reading a little bit of Morgenthau and then going off and trying to formalize it in different ways, people still read the whole book. So the European tradition on that side is a little bit different. American scholarship, to be fair, does dominate, not in the least because the American scholars are better funded and they have better journals, better in the sense of wider circulation and generally higher quality. So American scholarship and Americanized scholarship tends to dominate Europe for a while. A lot of European political science ends up by default kind of becoming a shadow of the Americans. But there is still this autonomous tradition, and it is that autonomous tradition which becomes tremendously important for the next part of the story, which is where Hedley Bull fits in. In the 1960s, there was a debate, quote-unquote, in the journal World Politics between the proponents of tradition and the proponents of science. And the proponents of science were pretty much all Americans. Not all of them, but most of them Americans, or Americanized Europeans. And the representative of tradition, pretty much the only representative of quote-unquote traditionalism, was Hedley Bull. And I say debate in quotation marks because literally it was Hedley Bull take on, Bull versus everybody else. So Bull writes a piece called International Theory, the Case for a Classical Approach, in which he levels a whole bunch of different charges at the scientizers and scientists within the discipline. And then everybody else got to respond a lot, which is pretty much what they did. David Singer had a piece that he wrote in there. David Singer is the gentleman who was actually in charge of the Correlates of War project at the University of Michigan. And Singer wrote a piece in response to Bull, which is called The Incomplete Theorist, Insight Without Evidence. So that's the kind of tone of that quote-unquote debate. Epistemology was central to this. The issue was, how do we produce good, valid knowledge of the international, or of the political in general? How do we do this? What sorts of techniques should we be utilizing in order to make sure that we've got valid knowledge and that it is well-grounded and well-justified? How do we do this? Bull's argument is that you do it by reading a lot of stuff and reflecting on it. And the argument of the Americans and the Americanized Europeans is that you have to have certain kinds of systematic procedures for evaluating conjectures. And you've got to be much more formal, much more rigorous, much more detached about it than Bull would want people to be. And it's a debate that's not often carried out in the formal language of epistemology, but it's very much an epistemological debate. Very much a debate about knowledge and what knowledge is and what it means to have knowledge. This is sometimes called the second great debate within the field of IR. The first one being the supposed idealist versus realist debate, which never happened. Second debate has the important advantage of actually having taken place. We've got a document. It was a book that was actually produced out of that special issue of World Politics. So we know that at least there was actual controversy about these things, which is kind of interesting. And this debate was actually crucial. That's also crucial because Bull loses in the short term, and American IR goes on its merry way, having vanquished the idea of tradition in defense of science, and then goes off and tries to be much more scientific in the future. This debate eventually recurs within the American Academy. But before it does that, the fact that the debate was basically settled in the U.S. certainly didn't mean it was settled elsewhere. Enter what we might refer to as the English School. And the English School, which is largely founded by Hedley Bull and a colleague of his, Martin White, who wrote a few things on state systems, and then Bull edits a lot of his work and then utilizes a lot of his work to try to formalize something. Not formalize, not the right word. To try to basically invent a tradition of scholarship, stringing different kinds of authors and insights together, and coming up with this loose collection of English scholars, or scholars that are headquartered in England, so it starts to become known as the English School. This is a much more historical sort of political science, where people are much more interested in going back and getting the nuances of how particular particular configurations come about, how particular settlements occur, how particular conflicts are prosecuted and then resolved. And the aim of this English school kind of approach, which also has some affinity with traditional English study of international law, the aim here is to provide insight, not general laws. This is not a procedure of generating nomothetic generalizations. It is a procedure of generating insight so that people would be able to get a sense for how things are put together. That's basically the goal of this sort of practice, this sort of scholarly practice that Hedley Bull was a champion of. So not to theorize in the strong sense, but to flesh out and to make familiar and to weigh and ponder and sort of come up with nuanced but tentative sets of conclusions. Again, much more similar to what a historian would do, except that it's not history because it isn't as tied to documentary source criticism as history. It isn't as contextualized as history because there is an attempt to make a certain kind of claim that rises out of a particular case and becomes a little bit more generalized, though not universally generalized. And also, it is very focused on preparing people to be able to confront challenges in the present, which, of course, straight history would not be. Now, what happens a lot in English school work is much more focused on diplomacy, including military diplomacy and the use of force, and on culture, norms, various common understandings that are characteristic of the international realm. Those get much more play than economics. English school's always been criticized for not taking political economy seriously enough. And in many ways, I think many English school people just kind of, if they're being honest, have to stand back and say, well, guilty. That's not what they're interested in. So you don't get an awful lot of that kind of political economic sensibility in the English school. What you tend to get more, again, diplomacy, culture. How does Bull go about actually doing this? Well, you will note in the book that he spends a little bit of time differentiating between order and justice. He's interested in how things are ordered, not necessarily the question of whether that order is just or justified in any kind of transcendent sense. So it is in that way a very empirical study. It is about how order is produced and maintained, how reasonably stable sets of expectations about the future come about and then continue to interact and continue to feed back into each other. There isn't a set of spare definitions which are then used to order reality. Instead, what we get is that the notion of things like international institution come from detailed case histories of various objects and moments and manifestations. So we work inductively. We work from the ground up rather than working from the top down or from a set of conjectures which then have to be compared with evidence. Instead, there's a lot of immersion in the evidence and the thick details of the evidence and then moving up from there to something else, to a broader kind of experiential consciousness of how international affairs are put together. And in particular, starting out with detailed case histories often told from the perspective of various diplomats and other kinds of eyewitnesses. So that's the directionality of the thought. It is, you might say, interpretive. There are no hypotheses here to test. This is about making sense out of a structured field of action. And that's done by immersing oneself in it and its literature and then sort of systematizing up from there, but very, very close to the empirical data and the participant records, the observation records themselves. The goal here is to build something called international theory, to construct it out of sets of systematic reflections and cases. But to achieve something like a sophisticated sensibility about the international, which can be something other than a mere hypothetical conjecture, something other than a well-verified speculation, but instead something that looks more like a systematic representation of sets of experiences. So that's the kind of direction that this thought is moving toward, or moving in that direction, because you can't move toward a direction. That's the goal that this thought is moving toward, this whole procedure, this whole approach is moving toward. So a few questions to ponder as we work our way through Hedley Bull's The Anarchical Society, which is kind of the initial program statement of the English school. That's the importance that this particular book has. You might want to ask whether or not what Bull is doing in here is, in fact, scientific, and if so, in what sense is what Bull is doing scientific? Also, does this matter? This is a matter that gets debated quite a bit within the field of international relations, the scholarly field. We might want to ask for ourselves, okay, sure, people think this is important, but is it actually important? Does it actually matter whether or not Bull's approach is scientific? Perhaps it has other kinds of values, or perhaps there's something misleading about the question as a whole. So those are things that I think we need to try to keep in mind as we work our way through this. Turning to his specifics, he has a very particular view of the international order and its strengths and weaknesses and its solidity and stability, and we might want to ask whether or not it's too optimistic, or, as has sometimes been said, whether it is too conservative. Bull spends a lot of time at the end of the book defending the state system, defending the notion of state sovereignty, defending a lot of things that are characteristic of the existing order of sovereign territoriality. And we probably want to ask why, and whether this is acceptable. Or is he, in fact, simply being too conservative about international order? Maybe he needs to go in a slightly different direction, something for us to react to. Finally, I think it's important that we always ask with any of these folks, right? Even though Bull is much more historically inclined and skeptical of general covering laws, he's still a political scientist. He's still working within that tradition where they're trying to make claims, and those claims are supposed to be, in some sense, accurate. So we need to ask, are his contentions, are his conclusions actually valid? Were they perhaps valid in 1977 and not valid today? Do they remain valid today? Has he put his finger on something? Is there something here that's interesting? Is there something here of enduring value? Anyone who is engaged in political science has to wrestle with that question of enduring value, or what that means. You know, how enduring something can be. Think back to Weber and the question about science being something that continually undoes itself. But I think we need to really ponder this, really need to worry about this and think about this. Is it in fact the case that Bull has produced something that is insightful and uniquely insightful? Or is there nothing here that hasn't already been produced in other ways? And that, I think, is the major question that we have to wrestle with when we are thinking about Hedley Bull's book and Hedley Bull's work.